The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
I can't believe I actually lived this long without a dog. Like, what is the point? Do you know what I mean? Like,
I do.
Yeah.
It's really a joy.
They're the best. How did she handle the 4th of July?
You know, she's not terrible. I mean, she didn't want to go outside or anything, but she wasn't, like, terrified.
Dave's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you might not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and joining me all the way from the mean streets of Staten Island is Rob Janicki. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Keith. How are you?
I'm doing well, Rob. I'm doing well, aside from the jackass next door who's walking around with one of those blower things blowing shit all over the sidewalk, seemingly in an effort to clean something, not entirely sure what. Aside from that, I'm doing well.
I think she has something to say about places and people that millions ought to see and think about. It's something that millions of people feel right here, even though they may not say much about it. The grassroots, the real heart and hope of America.
On this episode of Abandoned Albums, singer-songwriter Kim Fox joins us in Thunder Love Studios to talk about dogs, Bloomington, Indiana, but mostly about her 1997 album Moon Hut. So here's Rob and I having a chat with Kim about Moon Hut. You saw, apparently, according to the interwebs, Suddenly Tammy. Did you see them at Vassar?
No.
Tell us about that, because hopefully in a couple of weeks we're going to interview Beth.
Oh, my absolute musical idol genius. So when I was at Vassar, I was exploring like classical and experimental music. I was doing all sorts of different things. And I also promoted all the concerts there. So I got into that. I got a little bit more into the business aspect when I was a Vassar. So I did, you know, Wynton Marsalis. I did the Village People. I did Billy Bragg. I did all sorts of people that I had up my senior year. And so for the first couple of years when I got out of school, I wasn't really writing music at the time, and I went into the music business. I thought, well, I know my passion is music, but I wasn't quite sure how to get into it. Anyway, my first job was I worked at MCA Records in the dance music department. Okay. I had an awesome boss named Bobby Shaw, who's still in the business and is just this like just passionate person about New York City dance music. He's the real deal of just a music lover and fan. And I didn't have that much experience with club music, to be honest, but I got very into it over time. And I would go to like the after hours club. I would literally go to sleep at like 9 PM, wake up at 5 AM and then go to a club, like, and dance till noon. So then I got another job at an offshoot of Atlantic Records. And I started dating a guy who worked there who was an A&R person. And he was the A&R guy for all of like the more indie pop bands at that period of time. And so he literally 5 nights a week, he and I were out at shows. And, you know, I have to say that at the time I had written music in high school and I'd always been musical. I always played, but I didn't really understand how I would fit into that, or I just didn't know how I wanted to pursue music. And he took me to a show at Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Yep.
And it was Suddenly Tammy. And there were maybe 20, 30 people there. And I had not only had such a deep connection to her melodies, chord changes, you know, she was a piano player and there was nothing, she wore no makeup. She was pretty, but with no, you know, pomp or circumstance. I mean, she just played her beautiful songs and they weren't in any even, you know, it was slightly Carole King-ish, slightly musical theater, slightly pop, slightly. And it was, like I said, the most beautiful music I've ever heard and still feel like that to this day. But it was also the fact that, like, you could just play a club for 20 or 30 people, and you didn't have to be, you know, on stage for thousands of people. Like, that this was something you could do. Like, I didn't understand that you could go play a coffee house for 15 people, and that was okay. Like, and that's really all I wanted to do. So, like, I went, wow, like, her music is amazing. She was just playing a club for 20 or 30 people. I had the best experience of my life. Why don't I, like, I'm going to write some songs, and maybe, like, I could play a show for, like, 20 or 30 people. And that would be the coolest thing ever. Like, I thought that was all I wanted to do. Like, on the low, like, just because I didn't understand that you actually could do that. Wow, what if, like, I wrote some songs and, like, I played them at, like, you know, Cafe Chenet, and, you know, 10 people came to see me, and, like, and maybe, like, two of them thought I was awesome. Like, what, like, how great is that? So it really started this whole, and I remember I went back to my boyfriend's house. We woke up in the morning. I went out and I bought a keyboard that I could sit on my lap. And he lived in, like, the smallest studio apartment you could possibly imagine in New York City. I'm sure you can imagine it. Uh-huh. And, you know, he would listen to music or watch TV, and I would have my headphones on, and I would start, and I started to write music. And when I had about, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 songs, Beth and I did a show together, and we did it at a cabaret club. It wasn't like a formal venue. And she played a little bit. I played a little bit. And then I think I cried for the next 24 hours. Like, just the,
what?
Just the relief. Like, oh. I had so much fear. And so there was so much emotion built up into performing, playing songs live. You know, it's one thing to do other people's music or to sort of perform in a play. It's another thing to write, like, personal music, mm-hmm. and get up there and perform it. I still can't even really, I still have terrible stage fright about it. Like, it's still too intense for me.
Wow. To even,
but she was there for me. And, she's just one of the most greatest songwriters of all time. And some of her newer music is even more beautiful than the Suddenly Tammy music. I mean, she's really an incredible artist, and it's amazing. It just goes to show you that you can be that amazing and not really have this humongous fan base.
Then from there, you got a publishing deal. Mm-hmm. And then that led to your record deal.
I had just such a lucky story because...
Oh, wow. Okay.
My boyfriend, Darren, was very good friends with a guy named Clyde Lieberman. Now, Clyde, again, he used to be a songwriter. And he started working then as a publisher for BMG Music at the time. Okay. And I had a keyboard, so I didn't really have an actual piano. So Darren told him about my music one day, and he said, oh, well, you know, I would love to hear her. So I used to rent a room with a piano. It was like $10 an hour or something like that, so I could actually go and play a real piano in New York. Mm-hmm. And he and Clyde met me there one day, and I played him some of my songs. And he said, well, these are beautiful. Like, do you have any demos of these or anything? And I was like, oh, no, I don't. He said, well, BMG has like a little budget where we can maybe help people record some demos. If, you know, I'll help you find a studio and maybe we'll go in and we'll record them. So he helped pay for that. And then I ended up getting what's called like a development deal. So they, you know, gave me some money. I could kind of live off of it. I think I had a part-time job at the time. And I would just be writing and, you know, helping, you know, they helped record some of the demos and things like that. And Clyde, I just want to say, is still a really close friend of mine. He lives in LA, and he is the music director of The Voice. He's been doing it for years.
Wow.
Yeah, he is, I mean, talk about like just a lover of every genre and kind of music possible. I mean, he loves everything from like experimental jazz to like the poppiest pop imaginable. Like, he's just an overall lover. So he's absolutely perfect for, and he's had that job since the beginning of The Voice. I mean, like, he's been there forever. He ended up introducing me to my first producer, Paul Mahern, who was an Indiana guy. That's how Clyde knew him, because Clyde liked to sort of stay close with people in that community.
The line between sanity and insanity is blurred. It's sometimes hard to know where one ends and the other begins. As a society, we have little tolerance for bizarre behavior.
And so I went out to Indiana. Paul and I did some demos. I fell completely and utterly madly in love with him.
It said you fell in love with Bloomington, Indiana. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. I want to suss this out a little bit. What did you love about Bloomington?
So I was born and raised in New York City on 71st and 3rd. And I never really lived anywhere else. I mean, I was a city kid. I mean, sure, we maybe took some vacations, but I was a city kid. And I had this weird fascination with just Midwestern rural life. Like, I would watch movies, TV shows about it. Like, I always had this just fascination with that culture, because I just didn't know anything about it. And it was so interesting to me. And when I met Paul, I really had never really met anyone quite like him. I mean, he was, and he's a true Midwesterner and has pride about it. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, he really loved that he was from Indiana. And talk about a music lover. I mean, have you heard of the Zero Boys? I didn't know about them when I met him. It's very pop punk. They were incredibly influential in that world. You know, like, Green Day is a huge fan of the Zero Boys. And like, but it was so interesting because Paul, even though he came out of that, again, he was somebody that turned me on to like the Beach Boys and orchestral pop. And he was just such a, again, a true music lover.
What you've been saying and reply, it takes all the strength that's left in me to pay attention and not let my mind wander all the time. I can't remember, have we ever met? I thought I knew, but now I don't think that I know anymore. I forget.
Chick and Mark Wood, who was another engineer, they opened a state-of-the-art recording studio in Bloomington. And that's where Paul and I ended up recording my first Moon Hut. So we did everything there. If you were a musician in Bloomington, which there are tons of, you wanted to record at this studio. And I don't know why the name of the studio is, I'm blanking on it. But even like Ben Folds came and recorded there. Like, a lot of people would just come to Bloomington and record at the studio because it had an amazing board and tape machines and gear and all sort of, you know, vintage stuff.
Rob and I often talk about this. It's like, a lot of the records, they don't sound dated, and that's what make them, well, that's what makes them so good and perplexing to us as to why some folks didn't listen to them or hear them and they didn't get the exposure. And that record in particular, it sounds so good. So good. The songs are great, but the sound, everything.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
I think, and that was kind of where I was going to go. with the songwriting. So you just touched on it. Mm-hmm. The sound is great, but I also think the songs have their own sound to them, regardless of the production, the way they're written. Mm-hmm. When you write that kind of music, it's always going to sound timeless because it's got that, you know, there's this eclecticness to it that keeps it fresh and alive. Bleed a Little, Allison. That song, I think, is phenomenal.
Thank you. You
mentioned earlier about being maybe a little bit, you know, nervous or shy, or, you know, writing songs that were personal.
Yeah.
And that's really haunting and dark, but it's also beautiful. Like, I feel like, you know, that kind of songwriting adds to the sound.
You know, I do want to comment slightly on just the actual sonics before I get into the songwriting. Now I'll get into the songwriting. You know, I really want to just give like 100% credit on the sonics to Paul, because, and not that I wasn't there or not involved,
sure,
but like I said, he really, by just being such a music lover, and we would just sit around and listen to, you know, so many different kinds of artists. And he was so influential in the community of Bloomington, of all of the, and not just Bloomington, just all of Indiana, of that quality, that he really taught me so much about, like, you know, the vintage mics and different amplifiers and how to get all of these different sounds. And I was really a rookie, you know, I mean, I knew what I liked and I had taste, obviously, like I like this and that. And I did have a lot to do with writing the actual parts, but it was really Paul. I don't even think I actually realized at the time, like, how much of a genius he was. I think I was sort of in my own thing, not fully understanding, you know, the sound quality of the album and what, you know, how amazing it is. I mean, I loved my album. I was really happy with it.
Sure.
But I think years down the road and doing more recording and working with other people, that I was kind of like, oh my God, like, you know, the first person I ever worked with was like this unbelievable, like, genius. Because we were in a relationship, he was really, truly, you know, probably one of the first true loves of my life. I mean, I had such a deep respect for him. And so a lot of the songs on there, when we recorded them, you know, would just be like him and I alone in the studio. And it was just very, you know, romantic and creative. And, you know, when we recorded Cowgirl's Lament, for instance, which is one of my favorite songs on that album, and I do listen to, that's the one that I probably listen to the most over time, like, that, you know, If the beginning of the song starts off and there's thunder and lightning, because like we were in the studio and there was a huge storm with tornadoes and everything else, and it was just he and I in the studio recording this song, it was a very, very special time. You know, I had a lot of classical training, in the sense that I studied, when I was in college, I studied more like classical and a little bit of opera. at that time. So some of the piano stuff, especially like with Bleed a Little Allison, has a little bit of that like classical influence to it. But as a kid, I was a New York City kid who grew up with musical theater. I mean, that was my thing. I sang in musical theater and I was at Broadway shows all the time. And so I have a lot of that kind of Tin Pan Alley musical theater thing. When I started to write more pop music at that period of time, then I, at that period, I was more influenced by, I guess what you would call like more female singer-songwriter, but indie rock. So I was really listening to, you know, every, you know, I was obsessed with, obviously, you know, Suddenly Tammy, but I mean, a lot of the great like Liz Phair and people like that. That's more what I was influenced to, you know, at the time. I loved like Mary Timoney from Helium. I liked, you know, I was exposed to all sorts of different things, especially from Darren, because Darren, who's the A&R guy in New York, we went and, like I said, I was out at shows every single night. So like, I remember, actually, this is a little bit of a funny story. One night we went out, I was really tired. And he was like, oh, you know, this show is just down the street. I really think you're going to love this artist. Just come. And it was Cindy Lee Berryhill. I was like, oh my God, I, you know, because she had Garage Orchestra at the time and it was totally like orchestral rock. And that's what I was like, loved. And I was into Bleed a Little Allison is a lot like that. And so I was a fan of hers for years. And we ended up like becoming really good friends in Los Angeles. Like when I first moved out here, like she was at a party and I was like, oh my God, is that Cindy Lee Berryhill? And my friend's like, oh, that's just Cindy. Yeah, come over, whatever. So yeah, like sometimes I used to sing with her sometimes at shows and you know, big, yeah, she's amazing. But she was a huge influence on me at that period of time.
The 90s was an interesting time for music overall, but particularly for underground indie sounding female artists. But that time, like you, women, it was one of the times where I think women were taken seriously finally and for a change in the music industry. And there was this great like moment where it was exploding. And of course, you know, as it always seems to be, it went away. And you were a part of Lilith Fair, is that right? Were you? Yeah. So did you ever think that there would be something like that and then celebrating female artists? And what was that like?
Well, Lilith Tour, I did the Midwestern dates on one of the years. And I did think a few Midwestern dates on the second, because I was promoting the album in the first tour. You know, it's funny when you're in it, because I was such a huge fan of so many of the people that were playing. And, you know, like Victoria Williams, for instance, was there. And I think we shared like a trailer or something. And I was like, oh my God, you know. And so it was Beth Orton was there. I remember I was a huge fan of hers. I was too afraid to even say hello to her. I was just totally wow. Intimidated. But, you know, it's funny when you're in it, because I think you appreciate the experience a little more after the fact. Because I think it's not that I didn't have a great time or that I wasn't like enjoying myself or whatever, but I don't actually think at the time that I knew the full impact of what it was doing to women. I mean, I knew what it was doing to me, but I think when you're on tour and, you know, we're kind of in a van and I was with Megan and Ron, I had two musicians with me. And it was like we were just sort of trying to get from place to place and then get in the venue and then find our stage. You know, I think the logistics of it was sort of a little and the fact that, you know, I had this album coming out. So I was sort of focused on that. Like, are people liking it? Are people responding? Right. That the global nature of what was actually happening was like at the time, like I think it took me a couple months after that to be like, oh yeah. God,
well, and so to be fair, it was so brand new. You know, it wasn't like anything that had really come before. You know, I mean, Lollapalooza was already a thing, but that wasn't specifically geared towards women. It was just, you know, a big time festival. But I guess you couldn't have known. And you know, when you're in the middle of it, like you said, the logistics and just playing the shows, getting your album out, and all that. Like, but yeah, looking back, I guess it's pretty cool.
It was really cool. And like I said, I think that it's just sort of hard for me to remember, because when I think about Lilith Fair, that's what I think about. Like, I think about, like, oh, how do I get to the press thing? Or, like, you know, sitting next to Sarah McLachlan and being like, oh my God, she's so articulate. Like, how does she talk so well about these things? Like, I think I was so sort of insecure in my own head about what was going on with the show. But the one funny tidbit that I always talk about with the Lilith Fair is the fact that my bass player, Ron, could not find a joint on this tour.
What?
And it was like women doing yoga in their dressing rooms. Like, there was like no, it was like the most un-rock and roll thing ever. I'm sure maybe he didn't ask the right people, but it was just funny to think that, like, okay, here you have this festival.
Yep.
And, you know, you think like Lollapalooza, you know, everybody's just, you know, doing drugs in the back. And then, like, you know, you're at this tour with like Mary Chapin Carpenter, and everybody's like, let's just go do yoga and like meditate together in the back. And like, no, it was just so funny. He's like, I'm on this fucking tour and I can't even find a joint.
That's gotta be frustrating. That's amazing.
To out him at the time. But yeah, like, we were all like trying to be healthy and thin, and, you know, it was like, yeah, we were not partying. Let's put it that way.
The things there are to see in this Middle West. Spring Mill State Park in Indiana takes you back. There's an old water wheel there, still running, just as it did when our forefathers built it.
When you were recording the record, was it a lengthy process?
We did it in stages. So I would say what happened is, if I remember correctly, we maybe recorded, so BMG would have paid for the recordings, because I had a demo deal with them. And so maybe we recorded, let's say, 6 songs, and then Clyde shopped them. So once I got signed, then that's when maybe DreamWorks came in, and we remixed a few things, and then I recorded the rest of the album at that period of time. I'm trying to remember. I have to maybe ask Paul. I'm not sure if a lot of it was done.
Really?
But I definitely, a lot of it was already done when I got signed. Maybe we recorded a few more things. And we might have even recorded some more things like while I was in the process of being signed. But the album wasn't 100% finished like the way its incarnation until it was signed. And then we made an order and there were a few remixes and things like that.
Very cool.
But a lot of it was already done. Yeah, like I Want to Be a Witch, that was definitely already done, because I know that was like a big song of getting signed. That was, and then Undiscovered was already done. Like a lot of those songs, I think, were like in the demos of what was being passed around.
When you're creating those songs and they're trying to figure out a single, do you weigh in on that? Or is it sort of a business decision where the suits, if you will?
Well, DreamWorks was interesting in the sense that they, at the time, because I was one of the first people signed, they really tried not to be suits, even though they were suits. But they really tried to be like, we're so artist-centric and things like that. So I might have had a little bit of a say, but I'm sure that, you know, I mean, you know, I don't think I cared that much in terms of what would be released first. I loved I Want to Be a Witch, so I didn't have any I loved performing it. I liked singing it, and it was a huge song at my shows. So I can't imagine that I had any problem with that being the first single.
Oh, good.
Down there. Yeah. And Ben, this engineer, Ben Gross, actually did a great radio remix of it that really extended the ending. Mm. And I remember Paul hated it. It might've been one of the reasons we broke up. He was like, I can't believe how commercial this sounds. It's so terrible. And literally to this day, like every time I listen to the remix, I'm like, I love this so much. Like I loved, again, he extended the ending, and it really kind of made the whole song like that up, 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 but up, up. And he looped it again. I still love it. Sorry, Paul.
One of the things I find interesting on the record too is I'm not always a fan of cover songs on an album. That's because a lot of people, when they do a cover song, they tend to do it pretty much exactly like the original recording. You covered Atlantic City. It's such a cool interpretation. It's such a different take. I wonder, two questions. Why that specific song, or why Springsteen at all? And how did you come up with the reimagined version? Where did that come from?
You know, I was never a big Bruce Springsteen fan, to be quite honest with you. I didn't have a deep dive into his music before I met Paul. I only knew the radio hits, and I didn't love like that sound. Paul was really the person who, like I said, he and I were just these, I mean, we could sit around for days and not leave the house and just be listening to music. He got me into Nebraska, and he thought that it was, I think for him, it was just a quintessential Americana album in terms of the sound, the sentiments, the theme, the way it was recorded, everything about it. And he really needed me to understand the meaning of Nebraska and how important an album this was. And so when I did the deep dive and kind of, you know, had the revelation, like, oh my God, like I didn't even know Bruce Springsteen sounded like this. Like I had no idea. I ended up wanting to cover Atlantic City because Atlantic City, I knew. I knew I was from New York, so I had been to Atlantic City. I knew those people. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I knew those characters, and I knew the sentiment, and I understood where they were coming from in that song. Or I mean, at least that was my interpretation. I never talked to Bruce, but I really, I was hit very deeply by that. And so it was interesting because I was never a big cover person either. You know, I was never somebody that really covered a ton of songs, and I still don't. But every once in a while, I'll hear something and I'll sort of be like, like I could do something totally different or like a little twist on this. And it doesn't happen that often. But every once in a while, I'll work on something. I would say maybe once a year. And it is like, I agree with you. I'm not a believer in like, you don't cover a song to sound like the song. You right. cover a song to do a version that's completely different.
Right.
I remember I had bought this just old janky piano that was like completely out of tune that we had in the house. So we recorded that at the house. I mean, I think that piano, oh my God, it probably has like bum keys on it and stuff. But yeah, we recorded it at home.
Wow.
Yeah.
It just adds to the whole allure that
yeah.
You mentioned once a year you might find a song that you want to reinterpret or reimagine. What was the last one? What was the most recent one that has danced through your musical mind?
Oh God, we might have to come back to that question. It's been a while because this year I probably didn't cover too many things only because I was working on another album. And so I had to do like a lot of my own practicing and things like that.
Tell us about this new record. I had never heard of Linus of Hollywood and I'm almost ashamed to admit that. So, but
oh my God.
Yeah.
A genius. Yeah. Yes. He's amazing. You know, we had just an absolute magical time producing my second album. And it was a tough time for me in music because you know, my first album wasn't a commercial success. There was a lot of money involved with it. And, you know, when you're an artist and when you start out being like, I could perform, you know, for 10 people at a coffee house, and then all of a sudden you get a publishing deal and then you get a record deal and you've got a lot of people counting on you, a lot of pressure. You know, it was very upsetting, and not that I was like crying about it. I mean, I felt appreciative in some ways, but I kind of didn't, you know, I didn't really understand it, or I felt disappointed, but my love of music still never faded. And so, you know, I was out here in LA and I did, you know, I was still recording and doing different things. And it was really interesting when I met Linus, because I was still maybe on DreamWorks at the time or just getting off, and he was just starting out. So to him, I was like this huge artist that he could work with, which is funny to say. But I mean, I really kind of put his name on the map slightly because people in the community knew who I was.
Sure.
Some of my second album, I did record for DreamWorks. So like maybe we went in and cut like 4 songs. And then after that, maybe I got dropped, and then Linus and I finished it, did the rest of it, remixed it. And DreamWorks let me keep those masters.
Wow.
Which was an amazing thing at the time. And I have to say, because it needs to be said as a person in the music business, that this was unheard of business-wise. Most record companies were just total jerks. And Lenny Warnaker, I wrote him a letter asking him nicely if he would just release them, because, you know, I knew my record wasn't successful, but that, you know, it was a great experience for me, but I really wanted to keep doing music and those recordings were really special to me. And he was enough of a human being.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And this was their whole point of starting this record company, was to be freaking nice to artists. Yeah. And he did it. And I just remember writing him a letter back and saying, like, I hope you just have the best karma ever. Like, this was so kind, because I know you didn't have to do this and you did it. So I got to keep those masters and put them out, which was incredible. And so Linus and I finished the rest of it in his bedroom. So fast forward, and about 6 years ago, I was getting divorced. I got into another relationship. That relationship ended. And it was the strangest thing. It was like music was uncontrollably flowing out of me. It was uncontrollable, and I don't know where it came from. It's unexplainable. And all of a sudden, it was like I had an album. I recorded them. I recorded just piano vocal demos, guitar vocal demos. And then I got really busy, and I just sort of sat on them. And every once in a while, I would like take out my demos and listen to them and be like, I have to record these. Like, I still love them. Like, I have to record the songs. You know, then COVID happened, and I really need to actually get this done. Like, it doesn't matter who hears it. It doesn't matter how many people, but like, it's been 6 years. I love these songs. I feel totally strongly that they need to be recorded. I had been in touch with Linus over the years, and I was always like, oh, could we record a song or two? And he was like, oh, I'm going on tour with this person. I'm too busy, da 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 da. And so I finally was like, I'm going to have lunch with Linus and just see what he's up to. We had lunch almost a year ago. And he was like, I have time. And I was like, I'm coming in. We didn't even have to spend very much time on this. Yeah. We recorded 6 songs, so I don't have a full album yet. But we are so in sync musically, and we can so talk about like stuff that we like or what we want it to sound like, that it wasn't this like belabored thing. Like, literally, I would go to his house. We would spend a day just doing the basic tracks of songs, 2 more hours another day, maybe like fixing a few things or adding a few things. Done.
Wow.
Like, it was weird. So he's just getting it ready actually for mastering right now.
So we can expect that autumn, earlier?
Yeah. Let's say autumn.
Okay.
Yeah. It's so funny. The guy who mixed my Return to Planet Earth is now a mastering guy. Lo and behold, his name is Paul Logis. So I guess he's going to be actually mastering this.
Awesome.
So it'll be fun to reconnect with him.
One last final question. I'm just curious how you got into the photography from music. It sounds like you didn't turn your back on music entirely, but how did you end up in photography?
DreamWorks had put a freeze, like basically I had like a monthly salary and they had put a freeze or something on my account. I was basically like we were in renegotiations or something. And during that period of time, I couldn't really do anything. And so friends of mine invited me to India.
Oh, wow.
And the reason that this is pertinent is because, you know, when I was writing for DreamWorks, like my album promotion was over and it was like, okay, you're going to write and co-write. And so I had a lot of free time and I ended up like taking a couple of classes in photography just for fun, like just not because I was just kind of hanging out. I went to India. A friend of mine gifted me like a camera with a really good lens and some film. And I had a really amazing experience there just capturing my experience over time. And I had never really been a photographer. My mom was an art historian. I loved photography. But when I came back, I took some more classes. And then I needed a job. Like, I needed to actually make money. And I ended up getting a job with a photographer in the Valley. But in the meantime, you know, just for fun, I would take, like, promo shots of all my friends. So, like, I did photos for Cindy Lee Berryhill. You know, I did photos for just, you know, to get practice. And so I just did musicians. I would say I got very obsessed with photography very quickly because The thing with music was that everything took such a long time. You know, I mean, yes, I would play shows, but recording, I mean, I'd be recording an album for 3 years, you know, or whatever before it came out. And with photography, I could take a picture, they'd have it the next day and everybody was like, yay, so happy. So for a little while, I would say for about 2 years, I did half and half. I still had my publishing deal and I was making a record with Linus. So I would do 3 days of photography, 3 days of music. And that was my life for a few years.
Okay.
And then, you know, when the second record started winding down, I did a tour, I came home and my photography business just kind of took off. I have to say the music business, as I'm sure everybody has told you, is really hard. It's a hard life. You know, if you're very, very successful and you're, you know, going on huge tours and whatever, obviously it's the greatest life ever.
Sure.
But when you're really struggling, you know, and it's like, I used to make a joke like, and then I had money, and then I had money, and then I had money. Like, you know, I really loved the consistency of photography and felt like, you know, I was ready to sort of leave the business part of it, not the art part of it.
Sure.
So, you know, I have to say making an album now with my own money and not having any pressure, it's just a joy.
I got to imagine it's wonderful.
It's just the most wonderful thing. It doesn't matter. It's only for me to like. I don't care. I don't need to care if anyone else does. It's literally for me to listen to and like.
You've come full circle, right? To seeing, you know, suddenly Tammy at Maxwell's in front of 20, 25 people. The same is true with you now. It's like, oh, well, I can just release this for 20, 25 people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you're an artist, you really don't have a choice. It's just what you have to do.
There's that.
And unless you're an artist, you don't really get it. Like it's sort of like, why? Well, because you have to. That's just, you don't really have a choice. If it's in there, you have to do it.
Thank you, Kim. This was delightful.
Kim, it was a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me. I am such a fan now of the podcast. Like, I've been like listening slowly to these while I'm like editing.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to the new release.
Yes. Thank you. I will keep it. Please keep in touch.
I will.
So awesome.
Absolutely.
Okay. Have a great weekend. Right, bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Many thanks to Kim Fox. The songs you heard during this podcast were all taken from Kim's 1997 album, Moonhut. And they were, I Want to Be a Witch, Cowgirl's Lament, and Atlantic City. Kim's albums are available to stream wherever you stream your favorite music. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums. And on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_Albums.
Many thanks to Ronnie Barnett, Bailey Leaf, Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Michael Janicki, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Peyton Janicki, and of course,
our executive producer.
Rufus Thunderlove.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.